And we will call the Senate Special Committee on Energy to order. Today we have with us Senator Wagner, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Stedman will join us in a bit, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator McGuire, Olson, and Stevens are excused, and expect Senator Dyson to join us in a bit, and Senator Green likewise. Today we have a request from the Alaska Gasline Port Authority to present to us specifically on export license issues. And a number of people have asked me, and quite frankly, today said thanks for doing this because they had some questions. And then the other part is project economics and feasibility. And Mr. Walker, if you would introduce yourself, put yourself on the record, and introduce your co-presenters, we would appreciate it.
And welcome. For the record, Bill Walker, Walker Levesque, Alaska Gasline Port Authority. Joining me today, to my right, is Craig Richards of Walker Levesque. And to my left is Radoslav Shipkov, a director with Greengate LLC, the financial advisors to the Port Authority, basically for the past, since 2000. So with that, Mr. Chairman, again, I'd like to thank you very much for this opportunity. We almost had an opportunity to sort of respond during the bigger hearings, and we didn't quite get there because of other issues that came up during our presentation. So we very much appreciate this opportunity. And also, since this will be the last time I'll address you as in this capacity, I wanted to thank you very much for taking this process throughout Alaska. I was able to attend many of those and travel to Barrow and other locations that I think Alaskans benefited greatly, and I believe those that were able to attend did as well in on behalf of the legislature. So I thought that was a great opportunity, and I thank you for it. I know it's a lot of work for your staff, just a ton of work. So, but again, I thank you very much for that process and for this process today to allow us to come before you and respond. I mean, some issues have been narrowed down on the Port Authority, on the LNG project, that deserve a clear response from us, an opportunity. Issues have been raised by a number of presenters prior to us, and we want an opportunity to respond on. And we narrowed it down. For your sake, we've narrowed it down rather than we sat in this room, Radoslav and I did a few years ago, for two full days. And I know no one wants to do that this time. So we've narrowed down those two issues, the export license and the project economics, and I'll have some comments, some wrap-up comments after that. So at this point, I would like to, and our approach would be, certainly we'd welcome questions throughout. This is not a hold the question to the end presentation. We'd like to respond to them as soon as they come up. So with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Craig Richards to begin on the export license issue.
Chairman, for the record, Craig Richards, Walker and Levesque. Counsel for the Alaska Gasline Port Authority. Bill asked me today to essentially present our view on the federal law governing the export of North Slope gas. We have prepared an analysis that's 12 single pages, pretty thorough, about this law, and upon request we're happy to provide it to anyone. And essentially what it does is it walks you through the legal framework the DOE uses to analyze whether export should be allowed. And what we're going to do today is we're just going to go through some of that law, and I tried to find the balance between boring you to death with details and sort of giving you enough detail to understand exactly how the DOE will analyze the issue of export. For the export of North Slope gas, there are essentially two federal laws that are relevant. The first one is ANGTA, the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation Act of 1977. What ANGTA provides is that before you can export North Slope gas to any country other than Canada or Mexico, there has to be a presidential finding that export will not diminish the price, quality, or quantity of gas to U.S. consumers. This is unique to North Slope gas. It's not a presidential finding that's required for any other exports. And as we'll see a little bit later, these findings basically have been subsumed by DOE in their analysis as well. So the presidential findings are not materially different than the questions that the Department of Energy will ask. So in addition to ANGTA, we have Section 3 of the Natural Gas Act. The Natural Gas Act does not apply specifically to Alaska gas, but is a general law that says before you have an export of gas out of the U.S., there is a presumption that it will be allowed, but the Department of Energy will do a public interest analysis. However, for exports to countries in which we have a free trade agreement, Mexico and Canada primarily, this export is automatically granted. So the finding is automatically granted. So really, the only time the Department of Energy has ever granted or ever looked at export license in a discretionary capacity, whether to grant them, is for Alaska, because Alaska is the only place that has sought approval to export gas. And that means in two different contexts, the Kenai facility and YPC in the 1980s, of course. There's a fairly large body of law relating to DOE's view on exporting North Slope gas because of YPC. And what's important to understand about the way the DOE goes about this is there's a decent-sized body of law governing whether or not to allow imports, and they have just adopted the import regulations for their analysis for export. So one of the reasons that the DOE's analysis to allow export is so friendly, it's because it's the exact same analysis they use to decide whether or not to allow imports. So again, what we have is DOE Kenai authorization since 69, and there have been, you know, 7 or 8 different export license renewals or issues or expansions or whatnot in the 40-year period. And then additionally, we have the 1990 and 1989 decisions to allow YPC to export about 1.9 BCF per day for 25 years. And that 25 years would start to run upon first delivery.
Yep. Mr. Richards, question on the Kenai aspect and the LNG plant there. Is it feasible if you entered into a partnership with the Kenai LNG facility to expand that and have the license as the umbrella for two different locations?
From what I've read, the expansion analysis is not materially different than the granting of the license in the first place. So I think you could, but you'd probably go through the same analysis that if you just got a new license.
Okay, but thank you. And Senator Wilkowski and then Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a copy by any chance right now with you of that 12-page legal analysis?
I don't, but I can certainly get it to.
I do.
Could I have my staff or someone run off a copy? It's just 12 pages?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if we have copies, if we could have them maybe sent to the chairman and then he'll distribute it to all committee members.
Yeah, we'll get them out. Ms. Long, we'll get those taken care of. So, I'm sorry, did Senator Wilkowski have?
Yeah, I just wanted a copy. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Senator Elton and Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks. You thanked us for our participation. I want to thank you for your participation, not just over the last 40 or 50 days, but for a long period of time. And on slide number 3 that you just presented, you talk about the 1990 Department of Energy authorization for YPC to export gas. I mean, can you discuss that in a little bit more detail? How transferable is that YPC commitment? Would it require a second decision by the feds before that authorization can be utilized by anybody else?
It certainly would require a second condition. In that, as I'll get to later, when they issued the license to YPC, what they said is, we want to make sure that export of gas, that the cost of that doesn't fall on the American consumer at all. So a precondition to export was that YPC had to essentially file all of the gas sale and transportation contracts with the Department of Energy for review. And after the Department of Energy got those contracts and essentially decided that they weren't in some way, that the cost of these exports weren't going to fall on the American consumer, then export would be authorized. So implicit in the YPC export license is sort of the second step you take before export.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, so I'm hearing you correctly that the 25-year commitment is a commitment to reauthorize. Nobody can start shipping gas to foreign markets without a reauthorization by the Department of Energy?
I wouldn't call it a reauthorization. I would call the second step of their requirement to sort of approve the gas sale contracts. So there is a second step to utilize that license, but I wouldn't call it a reauthorization.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And thank you. And Senator Wagner?
You know, I keep going back to a meeting I had with the Department of Energy, and Mr. Walker supplied me with a copy of the export license. The reason I wanted it, I wanted to ask the Department of Energy, and I did in March of this year, how strong they would look at, or how serious they would look at this export license if, in fact, a project went through. And I was told at that time by Bob Cronin at DOE who happens to be in charge of these type of functions, as far as I could determine, that number one, it would take an entire environmental impact statement update for the project and for the export license. And number two, and this was kind of reinforced by Senator Stevens the other day, he said he doubted very much, given today's circumstances, if there was a possibility that Congress is going to allow the export of the North Slope gas out of the continental United States. Now, that's just the best information I have at the time. He didn't preclude saying, but he said he, in his estimate, and Senator Dyson was right there in the room with me when we were told that, in his estimate, that's what he would see would happen. So that's what I have from the authorities in DOE. And the undersecretary was sitting right there in the room with us.
Response, Mr. Walker?
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Wagner, we appreciate that information. I think it's obviously it's accurate. You were there and had that discussion. As we have always said, I mean, there are two requirements for there to be shipping. One is you have to give notice, and this was a letter that was received in June. You have to give notice of the first shipment to DOE so that they can put a check on a calendar, know that the 25 years have started. And the second is that you do need to submit the contracts, the gas purchase agreements, to make sure that you're not going to ship more gas than you're allowed to export. Is there a possibility that the issue could be raised further? Absolutely. Senator Wagner is absolutely correct. We're aware of that. I guess our you know, we've read and reread. The only licenses that you can read are one is Nikiski and one is Valdez. We've read and reread those many times and are comfortable with the issues, and Mr. Richards will go through that in his presentation, why we believe that process will be successful. What is it the DOE looks at in granting those licenses or allowing an existing license to be used versus taking one away? So, you're asking all the right questions, and we appreciate your time with DOE in Washington to address that directly. We look forward to sitting down with them, with our project participants, with representation from the administration, from our federal delegation, to sit down and move that to the next step. We felt to do that prematurely would be would not be the way to do it. The best way to do it is when you have a project ready to move forward, the next logical step, and that's what we anticipate. As soon as this process is over, we would put that team together to sit down with the Department of Energy and find out the answer to that question. Very critical question. We think, based on the research that we have done and what led up to the granting of that license and what is going on elsewhere in the United States in the way of gas exploration and development, we're a tad bit biased, obviously, but we believe the answer will be a positive answer. And so, but more of that will be discussed with in Mr. Richards' presentation.
Yeah, if I guess there's two pieces to this. One is whether or not DOE will authorize it under existing law, and as we're going to cover, we're pretty confident that they will, because if you look at the analysis they use, nothing has materially changed since 1989. The second part of this is, will Congress somehow step in and act to change the law, prevent export? Well, we don't have a crystal ball. We have no way to know what Congress is going to do, but it's a little unreasonable for us to be able to fight phantoms. And the fact that Congress may come in and change laws, sort of like Parliament may come in and say McKinsey has to go first. I mean, these are potential things that might happen in the future, but we'll just have to address them at the time. So I was on page 4.
And yeah, if we could, Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Congress legally say Alaska cannot export the gas to Asia? Or
yeah.
And then I guess a sub question of that would be, I think there are current laws or executive orders that prohibit dealing with countries or companies that engage in transactions with Darfur, for instance, such as Sinopec. So I guess two questions, Eric, if you could respond to those.
The first question is absolutely Congress could step in and prohibit imports, exports. And as we'll get to later, it doesn't actually require an act of Congress, because in 2005, Congress gave the President essentially unilateral authority to prevent the export of any type of energy material, be it coal, energy source, I'm sorry, coal, natural gas, oil. The president basically has signature authority to do that already. And what was your second question again?
On Darfur. And I know there's, I think there's an executive order prohibiting U.S. transactions with companies that engage in Darfur.
In my process of researching this memorandum and this analysis, I ran across a list of all of the export prohibitions on the internet. I think it was on the DOE website, and it's 9 pages. I mean, there's an immense number of federal laws that, you know, you can't transport this widget on Tuesday. I mean, it's just amazing, sort of, in a country with free trade, that there are a bunch of these limitations out there.
So just to follow up, though, but so you're saying there, Congress has the unfettered ability to say to the state of Alaska, you can't export your resources to China, for instance, or you can't export your resources out of the country. I mean, how could they say you, can they pick a specific country? Could they say you can't export to China, but you can't export to Canada, for instance?
I'm certainly not an expert in this area of the law, but as far as I know, they can.
There's no due process or
constitutional arguments?
Yeah, no constitutional arguments there.
Not that I'm aware of. But that doesn't mean they're out there. I haven't researched the area.
Yes. Senator Wagner has a question. Senator Dyson.
Well, I was just going to follow up on that. They already do that with the crude oil. There are prohibitions on exportation of crude oil. The only crude oil I know of that can be exported at this time is out of Cook Inlet, not out of Valdez.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was working for British Petroleum on the Prudhoe project in 1971. And years that we waited for the pipeline thing, and this was a huge debate, and a lot of folks in the South 48 are really outraged at the thought that any of Alaska's crude would go to the Pacific Rim. And you know the old saying, perception is reality in Washington politics, and facts are interesting but irrelevant. And that's why, you know, the Congressional Act, the Northern Pipeline Act, is, if I got that right, really anticipates that this gas is for North America's energy independence. I think that's the widespread perception in the American population and, by and large, in Congress. And with people paying the gas prices that they are and will pay, I think that there will be tremendous resistance to the export of the gas, even though most of us know that that could make an awful lot of sense economically, particularly given the spot prices in the Far East right now. And I think it's in that very regard that Bud Albright, Undersecretary, and Senator Stevens just said, in essence, it's not going to happen in any time in the short term. I hope they're wrong, my guess is they're right. And I just see that as a huge, huge hurdle to get past. Remember, yep. Churchill said famously, "You can always trust the Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted all of their possibilities." Unfortunately, I don't think we're...
What year was that? No. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Walker.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Wagner, I just want to respond to your comment about the export. You're correct. There was a prohibition initially on the export of oil out of Valdez. That has since been lifted, and it was shortly after Governor Hickel became governor that ban was lifted. There have been a few shipments, not a lot, but there have been some shipments. And I guess... you're absolutely correct, Senator Dyson, to the chair, that about the sense of that what Congress could do. I would think that we are in a different situation than we were on the Taft oil pipeline. As we recall, that required an act of Congress. That required, it was a tie vote and was decided by Vice President Agnew. There were certain conditions commensurate with the oil pipeline that are just not there on a gas pipeline. And so it really, it's not a perfect analogy. I mean, it's certainly we have to learn from history, and I'm a big believer in that. But we feel we can distinguish this from the oil pipeline just because of Well, someone said to me, anytime you ask Congress for something, you better be ready for some conditions, because when they grant something that you couldn't get otherwise without their permission, that sets up an opportunity for conditions to be set. We don't see anywhere in this scenario that we're going to need to go to Congress for an act of Congress. So, but I understand and appreciate your concerns about how Congress would act. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, and Mr. Walker, if we could just do a flashback, because the Port Authority has gone through some metamorphosis. Could you just give us a quick overview of what your current operating relationship is with different entities?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I should have started out that way. And we have, you know, when you're sort of in the trenches, you don't realize how many changes you make until you sort of look back or look at a former presentation. We began the Port Authority in 99, and we had different relationships throughout, different scenarios we began working on the Y Line in 2000 with Bechtel Corporation. Sort of fast-forwarding to where we had a relationship with Sempra for a period of time. They withdrew in about 2005, somewhat frustrated about ability to acquire gas and some frustration with the administration at that time. Approximately a year ago, a little over a year ago, we had our first meeting with Mitsubishi Corporation, and they were very interested in participating in this project, and it took almost exactly to the month, 1 year, to put that relationship together. Since then, about the same time, we continued to work with Sempra Energy, Sempra LNG, as a project participant. It makes sense because they have the only LNG receiving terminal on the West Coast that has now been commissioned, received commissioning gas. So that's a big, that's an important piece of what we are doing, because our markets are, of course, Alaska, U.S., and the Asian market, a blend of that. So our relationship now is with our partners. It consists of Mitsubishi Corporation, Sempra LNG, and the Port Authority. There are others that have expressed interest that we can't discuss today, but we're very pleased to have those are, we believe, major accomplishments to bring companies of that magnitude to this project.
Okay, thank you, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll try to go through this pretty quickly, but I still want to impart the general sense that the Department of Energy's analysis sort of follows the change and shift we've had in national policy of free and unfettered energy markets. You know, a big difference between 1971 or 73, when the Scoop-Jackson Amendment prohibited the exportation of Alaskan oil, was just a fundamental change at the federal level in the way we handle our energy markets. After that limitation was put in place, you had sort of the removal of quotas and things of this nature from oil. The natural gas markets were deregulated. You had deregulation occur in the late 70s, starting with Carter, through the 1980s, for the express purpose of having sort of a lack of government interference with energy markets. And that sort of overarching idea very much guides Department of Energy sort of thinking and analysis on the exportation of gas, Alaska or otherwise. So here essentially we have a DOE stated goals on sort of the rulemaking side of how they're going to allow their analysis to be driven, is that they want market forces to define the energy markets, and they want to minimize federal involvement. And essentially here's a quote from the YPC order saying just that.
Senator Elton has a question for you.
Thanks. And I may be leaping ahead, Mr. Richards, and if so, just say we'll get there. But since we're talking about market forces defining energy markets, I mean, one of the things that has seemed interesting to me in the TransCanada proposal is they have committed to building a line to Valdez if, in fact, those people who own the gas are willing to commit it. And I would assume that commitment would be predicated on several things, including markets in Asia, how long the contracts for those Asian markets might be, what the price would be, and the owner's commitment to bid in open season to doing that. And so that seems to be a fairly pure definition of market forces. And so I'm wondering if that definition of market forces is compelling to the Port Authority in whether or not to go ahead under the Trans-Canada rubric and allow those kind of market considerations to be brought into an open season, whether or not that works for you.
Senator Dillon, through the chair, we have listened carefully, and I read and reread those three sentences, four places in the application. I almost have them memorized at this point. We are encouraged with what we've heard from TransCanada on the simultaneous open seasons. Our comfort level was not. We're still working on that, trying to increase our comfort level on that issue. During the discussion there around the state, there were a number of questions that came out. Some were answered. Some we weren't quite sure how it was correctly answered, or maybe we misinterpreted it. So that's a very sensitive issue for us. We believe the market forces are such that an LNG project, shipment of gas to Valdez for an LNG project, would be successful. With the passage of a GEA, we would be required to work within the GEA process and work with your selected company who would have the exclusive license, TransCanada. As a company, we have met with them in the past, and we have a high regard for them as a company. We are not comfortable at this point where we are with regard to some of the finer issues that need to be resolved of how that would work. In other words, I mean, there's discussion about the initial open season, but what happens if the initial open season is not successful? Will there be a second open season, as it would on a Canadian route? Would there be a third open season as required under GEA? So there are some issues that we have not been resolved to our satisfaction at this point. We're still working on that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Just a quick follow up, and I may have misheard you, but you said you'd be required to work under kind of the AGEA umbrella, and I think it may be easier for you to work under the AGEA umbrella, but nothing prohibits you from going out and arranging financing for a separate project. Did I just misunderstand? Yep.
Senator Allen, through the chair, that's correct. And it would not preclude us doing a separate project outside of a GEA. The concern is we would not be able to receive the kinds of advantages, benefits, and incentives that are available within a GEA. So realistically, I don't see how we would ever work outside of a GEA if a GEA is passed, just because you're just stepping away from too many. I mean, there's upstream incentives that are available only through a GEA. There's a number of benefits that we wouldn't have available, and realistically, I don't believe we'd be able to put together a project without some relationship with the state of Alaska, similar to what TransCanada is entering into with the state through a GEA.
Yeah, I understand. Thanks, Bill.
And just to add to that, it's not just what we don't have access to, it's also the exclusivity provisions of AGEA sort of prevent the state from cutting a deal, you will, that makes another project viable if there's particular upstream tax inducements or other things that the project sponsor would want. So on a export license, DOE basically, in looking at their public interest analysis, this is what this comes down to, and decide whether or not the public interest overcomes the presumption to allow export. The DOE is going to ask three questions. The first one is, will national regional demand over the projected period of the license exceed projected?
Excuse me, Senator Thomas has a question. And before Senator Thomas asks his question, we have with us Senator Ellis, Senator Terrio, Speaker of the House, Mr. John Harris is with us, and Senator Dyson has joined us at the table. We'd just like to welcome each of you. Please, Senator Thomas.
I could let him, thank you, Mr. Chairman, could let him go ahead, but I did want to at least maybe get the question asked at this point in time. You can respond to it later after you get through some of this. I guess what occurs to me is not just the concept of getting a license, if that was granted, is the concern that something happens in the middle of it that causes one of the criteria that they use to change dramatically. And I look at the statement made on page 4, the Department of Energy believes that the public interest in free trade generally supports approval of proposed exports. I'm not sure what date that was said, but from what I hear all the squabbling in southern states with gas and fuel costing what it is these days, that might be subject to a little discussion. And so I guess my question is, if the export license were approved at some point particular time for even an extended period of time, say it was a 25-year license, I'm assuming that they still have the opportunity, or Congress at least would have the opportunity, to come back and shorten that one up or make sure that we didn't continue to export when we were in fact running into some of the problems that are enumerated on page 5.
Sure. Let's assume a blank slate, that we get a new export license, and you know, with none of the legacy issues with YPC, just a new one. In the past, DOE has never conditioned their export license in that way. They've never left the reopener clause. They certainly didn't for YPC, and then none of the export licenses for Kenai I reviewed. Did they allow themselves to go back in and change their mind, you know, during the term of export? That said, they probably could do that on the front end as a condition to the license if they wanted to. They haven't wanted to in the past, but maybe they could. And like I said, the third thing is the president just has the power at any time to stop exports. So you really don't need it, because the president can just do it with a signature.
And just one short thought. If that were the case, then obviously it would mean that there was a market in the United States for it. Obviously that was not being met, and that would be the reason for stopping the export. So it really wouldn't have a great impact on the project, other than it might artificially affect the price that you were able to sell it for, because you might be getting a greater price someplace else. But if they did demand that it be sold into the United States, obviously right. There was a market for it. So it's not like it stops the flow of the gas. It directs it to a different place.
Right. No, I can't imagine exports would be prohibited after they've started, unless, you're right, there was some sort of national crisis that you needed the gas immediately.
Thank you.
And Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you. Do you know if the Canadian government has similar authority to prohibit import of gas or prohibit the export if the gas came into Canada? Or is that the treaty, does that prohibit that in any way? Or does that?
I don't know. The short answer. My understanding is that we have a free trade agreement with Canada for gas, which, as I understand it, means that the other sides aren't supposed to come in and say you can't, essentially, you know, no artificial barriers imposed by government on the free flow of gas, but I'm not sure of the logistics of it.
Yeah, and Senator Wilkowski, we're still working on getting some Canadian representatives to come before so we can have those kind of conversations, because they're important. They're very important.
Thank you.
Since most of the pipeline is going to be in Canada. So please continue.
Certainly. So DOE, when they're sort of making their public interest analysis, is going to ask three questions. The first one is domestic production projected to be enough to meet domestic demand over the life of the license? The second one, if it's not, and this DOE doesn't project that domestic production will be sufficient to meet domestic demand, are alternative sources of gas available? And that, of course, means imports. And the third area is, well, all that aside, let's look at some various public interest issues and sort of decide whether or not any of these weigh in favor of not allowing export. And I've got a list of all of the issues that are relevant that I could find DOE has addressed in the past. And many of the issues that we've talked about today are obviously on that list, and DOE has already looked at in terms of YPC or Kenai exports. So I think that this goes to a question we had earlier, which is, will domestic demand exceed available domestic supply? DOE takes a very broad view of potential domestic supply, that is what can be produced in lower 48s. In 1989, the only party that really opposed the YPC export license was Northwest and Foothills, which of course now subsumed into TransCanada. And TransCanada argued pretty aggressively that you should take for national security reasons, you should take a limited view of how much domestic reserves are available for the U.S. over the next, say, 30 years. And DOE said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to consider reserves growth. We're going to expect the historical trail to continue to happen of new discoveries being found. And we're going to include in sort of our national reserve base an allowance for non-conventional gas sources, such as tight sands, shale, coal seams, and enhanced recovery gas. So DOE does take a broad view of what's available domestically. In 1989, they actually found that there was enough domestic gas that we didn't even really need imports. So export of gas from Alaska wasn't an issue. Today, it's unclear where DOE would land. We do know that right now, a lot of gas is being proved up in the lower 48s in terms of shale gas. You know, you hear talks of 500 TCF. It's a little too early to know exactly how much of that DOE would include in an analysis is available for domestic need. But nonetheless, I think there is a little bit of misperception as to the lack of available gas in the lower 48. It's not like oil. There's a lot more than people might expect. And until we do the technical analysis, there's no way to know where DOE will land.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for allowing the interruptions as we go along.
Please.
As stray thoughts flit through our minds here. I mean, how much gas are we importing now compared to what we were importing in 1989?
I don't know the answer.
Yeah. I'm not, Senator Elton, to the chair, I don't have the figures as far as how much gas we currently import. I guess what we have focused on is how much gas is additional new gas, new finds are being developed. And as Mr. Richards said, from the Permian Basin to New York and the Appalachian fractured gas area, they're predicting approximately 500 TCF. Some fields in the Texas area are 250. Haynesville area is very prominent. So it certainly appears that there will not be from the forecasting entities that we have spoken with, that there will not be a shortage of gas in the lower 48 near to a distant future. So that's a criteria that the DOE will take into consideration. I apologize, we don't have that number. We can certainly provide that to you, or an exact number, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, this is sort of the first question of, is there enough domestic supply to meet domestic demand? And even if the answer is no, there is not, as we'll see on the next slide, really that is not a deal breaker. Because the second question DOE asks is, there is not sufficient available domestic supply to meet projected demand over the term of the license, is there an alternative source of supply? And DOE has said that it's unduly simplistic to conclude that ANS gas exports will, first of all, diminish the quantity of energy available to the U.S. at all. And they say that because the alternative to Alaska natural gas export, according to DOE, may be that the gas remains stranded, just as it has for the past X number of years. DOE was sympathetic to the idea that export will open up the ANS basin to exploration and development, and more reserves might get proven up. And finally, DOE raised that just because you export gas to Asia from Alaska, that has the potential to free up LNG that was going to the Pacific Rim to come in on the East Coast, essentially. So they thought it was unduly simplistic to conclude that export necessarily means you have less gas available to the lower 48. But even if that were the case, the question is, well, are there alternative supplies available to meet maybe what Alaska gas might meet? And I think unequivocally the answer is yes, that sort of the change we've seen in LNG in the lower 48 in terms of receiving capacity and the coming on of global LNG projects means that the world market is dynamic and there are sufficient supplies available if the U.S. needs it to buy from overseas. And we have the receiving capacity to sort of turn that gas into a form usable by Americans. So it seems very unlikely to me that we could ever reach the conclusion that there isn't enough gas available to the U.S.
Follow up. Senator Wagner.
What do you estimate the current receiving capability is for LNG in the U.S.?
Radoslav.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Radoslav Shipkov. There has been a pretty significant expansion in recent years of the ability of the U.S. to receive LNG, but what has happened is, despite the expectations of significant increases in the imports of LNG, those imports, by and large, have not materialized primarily because the prices in the lower 48 have not been nearly as attractive to what has been available to LNG exporters elsewhere, Asia and Europe. And that is primarily because the lower 48 market has been well supplied with gas.
Senator Wagner.
So then what's the excess receiving capacity that exists today?
I can give you the exact number. I have to look it up the exact figure. But it's most of that capacity right now is not being utilized.
The figure that jumps out in my mind, if you go to the FERC website and go to the LNG section, they have a big discussion about this, and projected was 22 Bs, I think, just off the top of my head, but don't quote me on that. It was projected receiving capacity.
Mr. Richards, let me just add a couple things. I am not going to say when I talk to FERC, but FERC is in the state, all right, and they're doing their whirlwind tour and will conclude, I think, going across the North Slope and looking at what's happening in that vicinity. But some of the points you're making on this slide, I think you would find if you had an opportunity to talk to FERC today or tomorrow, they probably would agree more than disagree with the slide. Specifically, when it comes to the point I'm trying to make is we may be behind the mental power curve of where LNG has taken us worldwide and what that means. And then the other component is how vast the gas supplies or reserves in the U.S. are and how narrow the window may be and whether or not a gas pipeline at some point in time in the future would be looked at sort of as a Cro-Magnon that was laid down upon the earth. But I'll let you talk to FERC on your own. I did not say when I talked to FERC. Please continue.
Thank you. So we feel pretty strongly that even if DOE determines there's not enough domestic supply available to meet domestic demand over the projected term of the license, that they would find that there's alternative supply available because, as I said, it's pretty clear under their analysis that they've used in the past that it would be available. So that brings us to sort of the miscellaneous issues that FERC is going to look at and sort of decide whether or not any of these overweigh the issuance of the presumption for the issuance of the license. And I skipped a couple of them on the front, like Alaskan interests and the environment. FERC has basically said that in an export license, they're really not going to look at environmental issues. That has more to do with, you know, your environmental impact statements and your LNG terminal siting authorizations. It's not really a export issue so much. Also, in terms of Alaskan interests, FERC has repeatedly recognized in the Kenai decisions that export is in Alaska's interest because it helps them monetize gas, it creates jobs, and all these other factors. So certainly Alaska's interests weigh in favor of granting an export license. In terms of energy security, and this seems to be something that people talk about today, again, if you look at where the Department of Energy and the federal government in general has gone in the 1980s with deregulation, the overwhelming emphasis is on free trade and energy. And consequently, DOE said in the YPC license, and we have no reason to believe it would not be the case today, that our national insecurity is served by allowing free markets to work. A significant issue the DOE considers is the impact on balance of payments and sort of our trade deficits to various countries from export. 2 BCF is a lot of gas and is going to be an American export going to the region where we have the largest trade imbalances. So certainly in the past, President Reagan in particular felt that export of Alaska's gas was a great thing because it helped offset some of these trade imbalances. An interesting area that maybe I wrote a little bit too much on here, but I just found it fascinating, was what impact selling Alaska's gas will have on U.S. prices. And essentially what DOE said in the YPC decision, because of ANCTA, the presidential finding, they wanted to look at whether or not exporting Alaska's gas would lower prices to U.S. consumers. And they said a couple of interesting things, one of which was TransCanada sort of brought up the fact that if you look at a bunch of projected gas supplies, that there's always the skin of ANS gas coming on 15 years from now. You know, this has been the case since 1977. And what DOE said is the fact that some economists predict the ANS gas may come on in 15 years, that doesn't matter to us because that's putting the cart before the horse. They're just assuming the gas is going to the U.S. They're not really assuming the country needs the gas. So they said they're not going to look at sort of these projected studies that predict ANS gas will go to lower 48. They also weren't interested in getting into a comparison of, well, is a Canadian project or an LNG project more economic, which is better, which can get gas to the markets cheapest, essentially for the reason that they said that's 15 years out and these studies don't have a lot of significance 15 years out. So we're really not going to look at them. Rather, what DOE does look at when they're looking at whether or not exporting ANS gas would have an effect on American consumers is whether or not there's an alternative supply available that can be delivered at expected prices. And if so, then ANS gas will not have an impact on lower 48 prices. And what we know from DOE projections going forward is that non-conventional gas is going to supply by 2030 approximately half of all U.S. gas. Alaska's gas through Canada or any other means will not be the marginal supplier of gas in the lower 48. So if you remove that production stream, it is not going to change the price of U.S. gas. The marginal demand is going to be met by higher cost conventional gas. So prices will not be affected if you remove ANS gas from the stream. And this is the same conclusion that DOE reached in 89. And their expression was, Alaska's gas is not the tail that wags the dog on energy prices in the lower 48s. So finally, the last thing they looked at was, well, what impact would export of gas have on North Slope development? And again, TransCanada sort of made the argument that, hey, there's only 35 TCF of gas. We need it for a Canadian project. Export should sort of, we should get the first call on the proven gas reserves, and export should have to come in second. And DOE wasn't sympathetic. They said a Canadian line didn't have any first right on sort of Alaska's proven up reserves, and that the market will decide what goes, what project eventually goes and where the gas goes. And at the time, they humorously noticed that 13 years had passed since the passage of ANCTA in 1977, and that the gas appeared to not being developed. And so in their opinion, any development of North Slope gas was a positive thing because it would encourage assessment of the North Slope potential. Export had the potential of meaning earlier development of the reserves, and earlier development might lead to earlier discovery and proving up of additional ANS reserves. So pretty unequivocally, DOE viewed opening up that basin via an LNG project as a positive thing, regardless of whether it went before or after a Canadian project. So in conclusion, the Port Authority believes that the YPC license will be honored after the preconditions are met. We don't have any reason to believe they won't. But even if they are, we don't view that as critical. Because if you go through DOE's analysis and the way they look at this, it seems pretty clear to us that a new license would issue. And I think that covers everything. Thank you.
Senator Dyson and Senator Thomas.
Yeah, thank you. And forgive me if you've already covered this. It was a news flash here that I think you alluded to, that Sempra is back on board with you guys. And that is...
Senator Dyson, we can't hear you. Speak it in the mic.
Getting confirmation that Sempra is back involved, and is that piece of that their plant in northern Mexico as a receiving station?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that certainly is a possibility. We have not tied that to their participation. They are an LNG company, and they have the only receiving terminal, so I don't think it's a stretch to conclude that there could be a relationship between Alaska Gas and that terminal, or there could be a swap. I mean, there's something that happens a lot now is gas is swapped from one location to another.
And if I may continue, and as I remember, was there not a ruling that an LNG receiving station in northern Mexico that then ships gas to, in the California system and so on and so forth, that regasification was not sufficient to get around the Jones Act problems?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's absolutely correct. There was a determination that if we ship gas from Alaska to Costa Azul, which is about an hour and a half south of San Diego, it would require Jones Act compliant ships. And that's why we entered into the teaming agreement with BGT, who has 8 U.S.-built Jones Act ships. So that's absolutely correct, and we have taken that into consideration.
All right, thank you, and forgive me if you'd already covered that.
Yeah. Senator Thomas?
Thank you,
I'm sorry, was there something to add on the response to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to elaborate on this answer a little bit. Our current assumption is that based on where the markets are today, that 100% of the North Slope gas that is liquefied will go contractually to the East Asian markets because the price is the most attractive and it results in the most attractive value for Alaska gas. That does not mean that physical deliveries of gas would not occur to the West Coast via the Costa Azul terminal in Mexico, via swaps, as Mr. Walker explained. So it is definitely a possibility that we could be selling 100% contractually to East Asia and yet physically delivering some portion of that at some times in the short term or over the long term to the West Coast.
Yeah, thank you for that. Senator Thomas and Senator Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 9, what do you mean by non-conventional gas? You're talking about syngas? Is that the...
Non-conventional gas is just sort of the term that DOE was using to apply to... Well, I have a list here of exactly what they considered in their context non-conventional gas, and that was a...
It's shale gas, type gas, coal bed methane, those types of things.
So not necessarily synthetic gasoline or gas from coal gasification type projects or anything like that, since there's such an interest in the military in particular, who's the largest consumer of oil anyhow.
It's not primarily used in that context, yeah.
Okay. And the other question I had is with the... when you are unable to deliver your proposal to the administration for the to be in the time frame of the AGEA, those problems been straightened around? I didn't hear you mention when it was asked about the partners and if everybody was still on board, like Bechtel still there and those folks, or I wasn't sure what the exact problems were, and don't expect you to maybe, you know, elaborate on them at this point, but whatever those problems were, those have been cured or fixed. Those consultants or whoever the ones that were hanging on to the paperwork are now gone, and you've got that information as far as the project and how it moves forward?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's correct. We have all of our Bechtel's been working with us. Bechtel actually assisted in putting our application together, and so we do have access to all that that data, that's correct.
And with that thought in mind, then the project is the same project as was your original paperwork application, just with maybe Mitsubishi being a new rather large partner to the operation.
And Senator Thomas, through the chair, that's correct. The supplemental application we submitted, supplemental data per the request of the administration, does match what we are presenting, with the addition of the volume is still the same, the 2.7, right, with the addition of Mitsubishi to the and Sempra to the participation.
Thank you.
Yes, and Senator Wagner.
Yeah, help me out here a little bit. I've talked to ConocoPhillips, and their current contract for LNG out of Nikiski tied to cost of barrel of oil. Now, is that traditional in the Asian market, or is that not traditional? And if not, what would the contracts long-term be on the Asian market? And with the price of oil going down per barrel, wouldn't those market prices go down at the same time and react to the oil price?
Senator, to the chair, the short answer is yes. The Asian market prices for LNG are invariably tied directly contractually to oil prices. We actually have a fairly detailed discussion in several slides that will be in my section that address those points, and if you don't mind, I can address them at that time.
Okay. Are there any further questions at this point in time? I'd like to welcome Senator Green, and with that, we will take a 10-minute break.
That's the authority of the President's office, I'll tell you.
What did I do?
You just got us a 10-minute break.
A 10-minute break. We're going to give you a break.
Oh!
order, please. And Mr. Walker, we can continue where we left off on slide 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we do, I just want to make one quick comment. I was so anxious to comply with Senator Wilkowski's request to give him a copy of what we had done in the research by Mr. Richards. I gave out a draft. It's got some of my marks on it and whatnot, and some embarrassing that we did that, but I did, and we will supplement it with it's accurate, it's just not cleaned up. So we will email you a cleaned up version of what I handed out so anxiously a few moments ago. But one comment I do want to make, last comment on the export license. Again, I'm a bit of a student of history, and I look, and as we celebrate our 50th anniversary this year of Alaska statehood, I remember that battle well. My parents had a newspaper. We lived in a small community, Delta Junction, and we fought that battle. It was a battle. It was not an easy thing. When Alaska was granted 303 million acres from the federal government with a restriction, and I believe we're the only state that has this restriction, we cannot sell the mineral rights to that land. If we sell it, it immediately reverts back to the federal government. That's why we have the leases we have on the North Slope. That's why we have the process that we're in. So for Congress to tell us, because what they told us, you know, in 1959 was you need to take care of yourself. You're not appended to us. You don't have intermodal transportation. You don't have, you know, you need to take care of yourself. Here's this land, take care of yourself. Well, that's what we're doing. And we're in the process of doing that on the natural gas. So I would think that it would be a challenging argument for Congress to say, now you can't best take care of yourself for the following reasons, and deny us the ability to for our natural resources to seek the best market. So that's just something that's always been sort of troubled me, that it's not been developed very much. It will be developed, because it's very clear in the congressional record that was the conditions that Alaska was invited into the union, and so we will visit that again.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that. And it's interesting you mention that, because some of us sit on a board that's working on all the land dispute business, particularly as it comes to the feds, and you hit the nail right on the head. We as Alaskans have forgot about the institutional piece of that, and of course it's convenient for Washington to forget about it because it meets their cause. But I concur with you 100%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We'll now turn over to the second segment on the economics, and Radoslav Shipkov will handle that.
Mr. Chairman, my portion will address the economics of the LNG project. As you know, the Port Authority has shown analysis in the past, and the Port Authority continues to believe that the LNG project provides the most attractive option from an economic standpoint to monetize North Slope gas, both for the producers and for the state of Alaska. You, as the legislature, have also received an analysis from the administration in connection with their findings on the proposed AGEA license, which reaches effectively the opposite conclusion, that the pipeline to Canada is the more attractive option to monetize North Slope gas. You have also seen...
If I could, Mr. Shipoff, just to remind committee members, and this came up in Senate Resources, to the extent there was a slide in January 30th to be exact, where the slide said, commitment to evaluate LNG project options as part of the AGEA evaluation process. And I say that in the sense that we were a couple of months through the evaluation process and suddenly up pops on the slide an agreement to look at LNG, a commitment to look at LNG, when a number of us had been saying, why wouldn't we do LNG? It is a potential feasible project concept, and the biggest part of the phenomena, it's the most supported aspect in Alaska by Alaskans. I mean, even our governor was advertising on behalf of the Port Authority, if you will. And so it was that widely popular, and suddenly we were going to go through a process of evaluating contracts and not even look at LNG. So I just remind members of that, because we're going to ask the administration about that. Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess before we get too far down the line, I appreciate the comments. And I just want to say we've heard from TransCanada about their saying they're committed to building an all-Alaska gas line if the demand is there. And do you have any reason to doubt that they'll do that, or any concerns about their commitment?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it makes me nervous that there's so little said about that in the application. Truly, they're going to do that. That's one thing, but there's little said about that. And so I've had to rely largely upon comments and statements made by Mr. Palmer, which he's been very forthright, and he answers questions directly. I appreciate that. But I guess an example of what makes me very uncomfortable is today in Portland, Oregon, the executive vice president of TransCanada, in a presentation making reference to LNG, said they would consider an open season for an LNG project once the main line was completed. Well, that doesn't work for us. That doesn't work for us, and that's sort of an evidence to me of why we have to there has to be something more. I'm not out trying to be upset the process, but when the dust settles and the ink is dry, we need to know that we truly will have a pipeline company with an LNG only option if there's enough gas for that. So how do I balance those comments by Mr. Palmer, the application, and Ms. McConaughey today in Portland? I don't know, but all I can say is it makes me very, very nervous, and that's why we can't sit here today and say we can support the GEO process, because we're not here. We're here for the long game. We're not here just to see what we can get and move on to another project. We've been at it for 10 years. We're going to stay at it. So I don't mean to get off on a rant on that, but that's a very sensitive issue. When someone says, "Don't worry, we'll take care of it in open season." There's a lot more that needs to go into than just a couple of sentences in the application.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, Senator Wilkowski. Okay, thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Raslop, please continue.
Thank you. You have also received an analysis from Econ One, which shows a range of different results under a range of different assumptions. And in some cases, it shows that the LNG project is more attractive economically. In other cases, depending again on the assumptions, it shows that it's less attractive. What I would like to do today, my objective today, is not to reiterate our position, and certainly not to insist that our analysis is correct and another analysis which reaches the opposite conclusion is incorrect. I'm not sure that's a productive way to spend our time. What I would like to focus on is a discussion of the factors that cause the analysis to differ and what lies behind the discrepancy in the different conclusions. As you might expect, assumptions are key in drawing any conclusions from an economic analysis. Assumptions determine the outcome. So the analysis themselves are not invalid or incorrect. They're depending on what assumptions are selected to reach those conclusions. Netback pricing is primarily a function of two things. It's actually solely a function of two things. It's what price is being achieved, what price can be achieved in the target market, and what is the cost of transporting the gas from the place where it's produced to that market. If different assumptions are used for the pricing portion of the two elements that are necessary to arrive at netback, and different assumptions are used for the cost of getting the gas to the market, clearly different conclusions will be reached as to the relative attractiveness of two separate monetization options. The principal element that determines the cost of transporting the gas to the market is capital cost of the different project economics. So we will spend a little bit of time where we disagree and why we disagree in that element. And also we have different assumptions with respect to what prices will be achieved in relative sense between the two options, in the Asian LNG market in our case and in the Alberta gas markets in the pipeline case. First, I would like to spend a little bit of time just quickly going over what is the project that the Port Authority proposed. It is, as is shown on the slide, it's a 2.7 BCF delivered to the LNG plant in Valdez, a little bit more than that amount on the north slope going into the pipeline to account for fuel consumption in the pipeline. I should note that there's an assumption for 95% availability of the LNG plant, which means that on a average calendar day basis, the actual amount of gas that flows is less than 2.7, so that works against us in terms of cost because we have to spread the cost over fewer total MMBTUs delivered. That certainly has been taken into account. And what I want to make sure that is clear is that we have not proposed a project of 4.3 BCF LNG. We have seen an analysis of such a project being provided to you, but that's not the project we have proposed. We believe that that's too much LNG to be attempt to sell in the Asian market as in the initial phase. It might be possible as an expansion in the future, but we do not believe it will be viable initially. And therefore, we have not proposed it, and we do not intend to focus on that option. We're solely going to explore the 2.7 BCF option. On the next slide, you will see a very high-level comparison between the assumptions that were used by the Port Authority and the assumptions that were shown in the P50 evaluation in the administration's analysis. You can see that on the pipeline component, the capital cost developed by Bechtel for the Port Authority is higher than the number that the administration used in their P50 case. However, on the LNG facilities, the discrepancy works the other way, and it's a substantial difference. This is the key factor on the capital cost side that causes discrepancy in the results. We have, on previous occasions, spent some time
talking. Excuse me, right, Mr. Shipoff. Excuse me, right there. Did the Port Authority have a discussion with the administration on the difference of your course of action versus their course of action during the process of evaluating LNG versus a GEA applicant?
Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bill Walker, actually not. We actually proposed that we would participate in that process and make available Mr. Shipkoff and the work that Bechtel had done, et cetera, and that was declined. They chose to keep it a separate, completely separate. After the work came out, we did request a copy of their model so we could really understand. I mean, this is a big discrepancy in billions of dollars. So really the best way is to look at the model, and we asked for that, and we're not – we're not provided a copy of that model. We did provide them a copy of our model with our in our application, so we can't really pinpoint where that came from.
So you did not get a copy of the administration's model?
No.
How they researched it?
Sure, we have not.
Okay. And you requested that?
We have. That's correct.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to actually elaborate on this point a little bit. In my experience, whenever I have encountered a situation where there is a significant disagreement about parameters of a technical nature, the best way to make sure that everybody's on the same page is to have the engineers on both sides talk to each other. And unfortunately, we did not have this happen.
Okay. Thank you.
On previous occasions, we have had the opportunity to address the difference in methodologies employed to estimate the costs of the LNG plant used in our analysis and in the administration's analysis. I do not want to spend too much time on this here. However, I will just mention the key points. The Bechtel estimate was developed as a bottom-up estimate. It was updated in 2007 as a result of a three-month extensive review that built up on a nearly 10-year work that Bechtel had done for the Port Authority prior to that. So there was a very substantial and long-standing involvement on their part in connection with the Port Authority's project.
Mr. Shipkoff, let me interrupt you right there. Senator Thomas has a question for you.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Backing up just a little bit to your slide 14, the gas conditioning plant, I'm assuming that is to be built by others. That's why when we get to slide 15, that's not included in the cost there. Is that correct?
That's correct. In the application, we assumed that the conditioning plant will be built by others, and the application did not explicitly include an estimate for the conditioning plant. However, in the process of developing the work that went into the application, Bechtel also developed a cost estimate for the GCP, even though the assumption was that commercially it would be outside of the scope of the project. They did not, in fairness, they did not spend as much time vetting, in my understanding, is that cost estimate. So we have relatively less confidence in the GCP plant, primarily because it was decided at some point along the process that it was going to be excluded from the scope.
Guesstimation, though, is about $5 billion. Is that the...
The Bechtel number for the GCP plant for the $2.7 billion project was less than that. I believe it was in the order of 3.5 billion. However, you will see that when we get to the point where we compare the net back results for the two projects later in the presentation, we have assumed the administration's cost estimate for the GCP because it was higher.
And one other little clarification, if I may, is there are some that indicate that for a smaller project such as this, that a conditioning plan may not necessarily even be needed, that there is the central compressor station and other facilities that exist at Prudhoe that may well at least be capable of being hooked up to a line without as much conditioning taking place.
Well, the CO2 will definitely have to be extracted on the north slope. Now, to the extent that there is technical capability to do that with existing facilities, I don't know. This is something that the engineers have to address. What I can say in this context is that from the beginning of Bechtel's involvement, they have always assumed that once the actual work proceeds and there's a project that is being developed and the technical work is taken to pre-feed and feed stages, in other words, significantly more detailed type of analysis than what is being performed for this purpose, the capital costs will be optimized because there will be a discussion between, we will have a commercial arrangements with the producers, and there will be a discussion how to optimize the technical design in a way that maximizes any synergies that might exist from existing infrastructure. In the absence of such a discussion at this point, the safe assumption was made that, to be conservative, we have to assume that no existing infrastructure will be used. So everything is built up from scratch. In reality, that's unlikely to actually happen. Surely there will be ways to integrate the project with the existing infrastructure.
Thank you.
But Mr. Skipoff, for the people at home, when comparing the two courses of action, it was. The gas treatment plant was not in either course of action. Is that accurate? It was apples to apples. Not one course of action had a gas treatment plant. The other did not. Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's
okay. Correct. Good. I just want to clarify that. Senator Wagner.
That's my understanding, at least. I don't want to speak for TransCanada's proposal, but my understanding is that they also assumed that the conditioning plant will be outside of the scope of their project.
They said they would build it if no one else agreed to. Senator Wagner.
Yeah, and I was going to address that. I think we always get held up and stuck with the gas treatment plant. And I don't know any other project, or I haven't had anybody tell me any other project that's done of this nature or anything close to it, where the companies are not responsible for sending the pipeline ready gas. So I'm wondering why we keep talking about the gas treatment plant, because if the North Slope producers are going to sell their gas, they've got to treat it before they sell it into the pipeline or deliver it to the pipeline. That's always the case in any other application. If it isn't, I'd like somebody to tell me that.
There are some people touring the state that may not agree with you right now, but you can talk to them yourself on that.
But those people from FERC, they don't have that much to do with the treatment of the gas. Gas is delivered to a pipeline, and it's delivered pipeline ready with the CO2 and the impurities taken out of it. They can leave the liquids in it, but you know, that's the way it's done. That's the industry standard. So I think we waste our time continuing to go over and over this gas treatment plant, because if the gas gets sold, it'll be treated before it's sold.
Yeah. Okay, please continue. Okay.
Now, in contrast to the methodology and the way the cost estimate for the LNG plant was developed by Bechtel, our understanding of the administration's approach, as described in Chapter 4 of the findings, is that it was described as a top-down approach developed by data mining of a database which included cost figures for LNG projects of a wide-ranging geographical scope, basically LNG projects all around the world. Then a generic cost per ton figure was derived from that database, which was then applied for the purposes of arriving at an estimate for the project that was being evaluated with an LNG plant in Valdez. There are some limitations to this approach. It's a valid approach. It's done very on many occasions when bottom-up estimates are not available and specific estimates developed for the purposes of a specific project which take into account the project-specific conditions are not available. However, there are some limitations to it because cross-project comparisons can be very difficult by nature. LNG plants are not all the same. There are many differences that are associated with the location, with the scope, with the feed gas composition, and other such unique project-specific factors that have to be taken into account. For example, many LNG projects around the world include the cost of treatment as part of the scope of the LNG plant because they have dedicated gas supply specifically for the development of the LNG project as a monetization scheme. That will include liquid slug removal, condensate stabilization, acid gas removal, water removal, mercury removal, and everything else that goes along with the treatment of the gas. For our project, that cost is going to be part of the conditioning plant. Feed gas pressure for this project is a unique feature which I have not seen anywhere else in any other LNG projects. LNG terminals, liquefaction terminals, is a very large component of their cost, the cost of compressing the gas to bring it down to the, to bring it up to the pressure required for converting it into LNG. The feed gas for this project is going to come from a very high pressure pipeline, which is going to be the dense phase pipeline from Prudhoe Bay to Valdez. We have been told by the engineers at Bechtel that just this feature alone, that the fact that the gas comes at a very high pressure can save something in the order of 30% of the cost of the LNG plant in comparison to a plant that did not benefit from such high pressure feed gas. So in other words, if the plant were to be compared with a plant that did not benefit from such high pressure feed gas, you would have a portion of the capital cost which would otherwise be in the plant, essentially be in the pipeline compressor stations. Ambient conditions also have play a significant role. Most LNG projects around the world are built in warm climates. Cold climates, believe it or not, affects directly the capital cost of an LNG plant because the efficiencies improve with drops in temperature. So that has to be taken into account as well. There are additional project-specific factors that also have to be taken into account that are almost entirely determined by location-specific factors. These are marine terminal facilities. Is there dredging required? How far the jetty has to extend? And so on. The Bechtel estimate was based specifically on work performed taking the Anderson Bay conditions into consideration. Now, I should point out that even if all of these location-specific and project-specific factors are taken into account and the database is adjusted to take them into account, you will still have significant variation from project to project because different projects approach the market at different times when there are different conditions in the market for EPC services. One of the main reasons why projects around the world, not just LNG projects, pipeline projects, petrochemical projects, have experienced significant capital cost overruns in the recent years is because we are living in an environment of a very tight EPC market. There simply are not enough qualified engineering firms out there to do all the work that is being requested. So there's huge backlogs at Bechtel, KBR, and name it, all of the major contracting firms. That has a direct impact on the capital cost. So if you're comparing a project that was that went to the market in 2006 or 2007 and suffered from adverse EPC contract conditions with a project that was built in 2000 or 2001, even if you adjust for all the technical parameters, you're going to have a severe discrepancy between the two numbers, simply because they approach the market at a different time. So I want to make it very clear that I'm not suggesting that the approach used by the administration's technical consultants was incorrect. I'm saying that it has limitations and they should be recognized. And more importantly, it's a top-down approach is not a substitute from a bottom-up approach, and we would have preferred if the administration had allowed their technical consultants to talk to our engineers to make sure that everybody's on the same page. That would have, in our opinion, that would have been a preferable approach. The result of using the top-down approach for the LNG project and the bottom-up approach for the pipeline and comparing the results of that analysis with an analysis of the pipeline using only a bottom-up approach for the pipeline is that essentially you're mixing two different methodologies, which introduces a element of inconsistency into the comparison, and therefore, in my mind, compromises the validity of the comparison.
Well, Mr. Skipoff, let me ask you there. Your confidence level in the administration's analysis on a scale of 1 to 10, what is it?
I don't know, because I have not seen the underlying database that has been used to assess the top-down level to cost dollars per ton figure that was used to derive a capital cost estimate for the LNG plant. In the past, we have had interaction with some of the, not all of the administration's consultants, but some of them, and I have, in my mind, they're highly qualified people. I have no doubt that they have made every effort, given the limitations that were imposed on them, to arrive at as accurate a number as they could. The problem is that a top-down approach is no substitute for a bottom-up approach. And through no fault of the technical experts, they were given a limitation that they could not use a bottom-up approach and they could not talk to the Port Authority's engineers to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Well, you said they were given the limitation that they couldn't use a bottom-up?
Well, the limitation arose from the decision to exclude the Port Authority's application. Therefore, they could not use any of the Port Authority's materials in their analysis. This is my understanding of what happened.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Richards, you have something to say? I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry, Senator Wagner.
What was your capital cost assumption in your application?
So EPC cost $7 billion without escalator. I'll go back to this slide here. So the $8 billion includes EPC cost of $7 billion, not including the escalation after 2007. In addition to that, there are owner's costs that are added on top of that, which is, you have insurance, project management costs, development costs, and of course, certainly you have to include the escalation from 2007 to convert the number into nominal terms. So the total without the escalation is $8 billion. The total with escalation really depends on the timing. But for the purposes of the analysis that is shown further in the presentation, we have assumed 4% cost escalation to be consistent with the administration's assumption. Does that address the question?
There's a little discrepancy between Port Authority's listing here and I think what your application was, but I'll talk to you about it later. And one other question, and I think this is important no matter who does an LNG project or not. I just want to get your thoughts on it and everything. Most places in the world that ship LNG, their gas supply is very close to the water and to the plant. We're talking about a $2 plus tariff to get the gas from the North Slope to the plant. Yeah. So isn't that an unfair or a disadvantage to you when you start competing in the marketplace with anybody else on LNG, given the fact that if your shipping distance is the same?
The issue is that different projects will always have different costs of delivering. It will be very unusual to see a situation where all projects have the same cost of delivery to the market. There certainly will be projects that have lower costs, and there are projects that have higher costs. The question is, can a project deliver its product to the market below the price which it can attract in that market? Most LNG projects that target the U.S. market, whether it's from the Middle East or from West Africa, are estimated that they have the capacity to deliver to the Gulf Coast at something like $3.50 per MMBTU. So that's a low number in comparison to what we will have to face. Now, let's say that we're targeting a market in which we can deliver at $5 and somebody else can deliver at $3.50, and the price is 8, 9, 10, or higher. Both projects will be able to deliver successfully and profitably. It's just that one project will have a higher netback than the other one. One will be more profitable than the other, but that does not make the project with the higher cost unable to compete. The question is, if you can deliver under the price that's expected, in other words, you're not the marginal supplier. If you're the marginal supplier, then you have an issue. LNG is generally not considered to be the marginal cost of supplier in today's marketplace. It's, as we discussed earlier, it's considered to be non-conventional supplies.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The administration projected the tariff for the LNG export to be about $10 an MCF, I believe, which seemed extremely high to me, considering that the tariff for down Alberta, they projected somewhere in the $4-$4.50 mm-hmm. range. Mm-hmm. What do you project the tariff to be for LNG?
Very roughly speaking, we the pipeline is about $2, the liquefaction is about $1.50, shipping, marine shipping is about $1 in nominal terms, and we have about, if I recall correctly, about 60 cents or possibly higher of total fuel consumption.
What's that? So what's the total there?
5.10.
Yeah.
How much?
5.10.
5.10, okay.
I'm sorry, did you say 5.10?
I would like to answer Senator Wilkowski's question accurately rather than just off the top of my head so I can provide the exact figure from the model.
Yeah, if you just compute it and get it to Ms. Long, she'll make sure everybody gets a copy. Thank you. Please continue, unless there's a follow-up.
I mean, I guess if you could just briefly tell us, it's a huge discrepancy. Just in a nutshell, I mean, where's the discrepancy?
Well, the key element is the LNG plant. Now, you also have to be careful when you compare numbers, because we may be talking about the same cost, but in different terms. For example, cost per MMBTU where delivered or on the North Slope, right? If you're talking about the cost per MMBTU delivered, it's going to be a higher number because you're losing BTUs as you move along the way. It's still the same cost, right? But you're expressing it in what terms? If it's cost per MMBTU on the North Slope, it's going to be a lower number. So sometimes the discrepancies are actually not differences in assumption, but what's the number that's being put out there? In comparisons, you have to make sure that you're comparing the same things. If we, when we have compared our numbers and the numbers that are generated from our model with what Econ 1 showed to the legislature in their analysis, we saw that it gave us comfort about the validity of our analysis, that if we used the same assumptions that they used, almost invariably we came very close to what they were showing. So. At least with respect to a comparison with Econ 1, we have comfort, and the reason I'm saying Econ 1 is because they put out there a very wide range of sensitivities, so we could make the comparison for many different cases to make sure that we are not generating, using the same assumptions, we're not generating results that are completely out of the ballpark. We had a little bit more of a limitation in terms of comparing with the administration because there were just fewer data points to compare with. And it wasn't always clear to me in some instances what had gone behind some of the numbers that were put out there. So just it was difficult to make the comparison. Again, these are the types of disagreements where if you have numbers that vary so widely, the best way to resolve the difference is to actually start looking at the models and why are we calculating different numbers, right? If we are using the same assumptions, we ought to be arriving at the same numbers. And sometimes it's, as I said, it's as simple as, are we actually talking about the same thing? Is it cost per BTU delivered, or is it cost per MMBTU at the front end?
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I think Alaskans would agree with you that we at least owe to the Port Authority to do some basis of comparison so you're in a comfort zone, because Alaskans are very supportive of your concept. But please continue.
The next topic that I would like to address is prices both in the Asian LNG market and the North American market. And this will address, hopefully, Senator Wagoner's questions earlier. In the Asian LNG market, prices are typically set on a bilateral basis under long-term sales and purchase agreements, which could run 20 to 25 years. They're invariably price formulas which directly link the price of LNG to the oil price. Typically, it's linked to a basket of crudes referred to as JCC, or conversationally referred to as Japanese crude cocktail, which actually stands for Japanese customs cleared price. The pricing provisions for each contract reflect the market supply and demand dynamics at the time of the contract's execution. And of course, there are many contracts which were executed at different points in time. So there's really, in such a bilateral contract market, there's really no single price of LNG. If you look at the weighted average of all the markets, you will arrive at the weighted average of prices of LNG delivered to Japan. But that does not mean that if a project were to go to the market today, they will get the LNG price of the averages of those contracts. They will get a price that is determined by the conditions at the time that this contract is being negotiated. Now, this contrasts with the North American market, where price discovery is transparent and is driven by a spot market at regional trading hubs such as Henry Hub or AECO. This next slide shows you a graph from the gas strategies report, which was presented with the administration's findings. I think this is a very useful graph. It shows the evolution of the indexation provisions in contracts that supply LNG to East Asia, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And there's actually one line there which shows China, but for a variety of reasons, we have not focused on the Chinese market. You will see that if you follow the progression with time, and what the graph shows is on the x-axis, on the horizontal axis, is what the oil price is, and on the vertical axis is what the LNG price delivered ex-ship would be given a certain oil price. So, for example, if you're at oil price of 80, and you see at the top where it says end of 2006, the price under that contract would have been approximately $14 per MMBTU, if you go up to the top right corner. Now, with the evolution of time roughly about 2004, there has been a very steep increase in what prices LNG projects were able to negotiate with Asian buyers. The reason for this is because the market moved into a situation of a perceived shortage of LNG going to the Asian market, and it was considered to be a very strongly sellers-friendly market. Reportedly, typically these contracts are confidential, but reportedly KOGAS, which is the Korean gas utility, was able to negotiate, the Qataris were able to negotiate a sales and purchase agreement with KOGAS, under which KOGAS purchases the gas at above parity with oil. In other words, on a BTU basis, gas is more expensive than oil. This has historically not been the case. This KOGAS price is represented in the yellow line, which is above the black parity line in the graph.
Mr. Skipoff, could you say that again? I thought I heard you say that by BTU basis, gas is more expensive than oil. Could you
The recent KOGAS purchase agreement, under which they agreed to purchase LNG from Qatar, from one of their Qatari LNG projects, for prices, especially for prices below $100, the formula results in a price per MMBTU which is higher than the oil price in BTU terms. So gas, in other words, is above parity with oil. So let's use an example. If oil is $100 and we use roughly 5.8 MMBTUs per barrel, parity with oil would be 100 divided by 5.8, which is about $17 per MMBTU. That means that under that formula, the price of LNG would have been higher than 17.
Okay.
At $100 oil.
Let me just ask you to take a leap with me for a moment. You know, some of the economic theorists say that we've peaked in oil prices for this particular time frame in 2008, and that oil may go down to, let's assume it goes to $100. It's 126 or 5 someplace in there today, unless it took a hop, and gas was up at a little over 12. It went to 10.50, and I'm not sure where it is today. But let's assume that it's at $100 for oil, $100 a barrel. If gas tracked that, where would you see gas going to if it was 10 over, just over 10 today?
Gas where, in the U.S. or in the LNG?
It would be Henry Hub.
Well, in the U.S. market, you don't have a direct linkage between oil and gas prices.
Right.
They generally move together because some of their uses can be substituted for, in some of their applications, they can be substituted for each other, but there's no direct linkage.
Right.
And actually, the question that you're posing, which is, at a given price of oil, what is the correct assumption for gas prices in the U.S. is one of the issues that we're going to explore in the next slides.
Right.
I don't think anybody has the right answer for that. It's not clear. We have seen that the oil to gas price ratios that recently have been observed in the North American market have been substantially higher than what they have been in the past, meaning on a BTU basis, oil price is higher than gas right now.
Right.
That's partially because of the perception that the North American gas market is very well supplied.
Right. And then if you took that model to the Pacific Rim, what's the paradigm?
Well, there the linkages are direct. They're contractual and right. formulaic. So depending on the contract that you operate in under, if you're providing under a contract that was negotiated a long time ago when the market was much more buyer-friendly and you have a much more buyer-friendly formula, you will have a lower price. But if you're CoGas and you're now purchasing under their most recent contract from one of the Gutter projects, and if that price has been accurately reported publicly, if you're at $100 oil, you'll essentially be paying something around $17 per MMBTU.
Okay, thank you. And we have questions from Senator Thomas and Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was kind of my question, was how do these contracts operate? Is that the norm now, you're saying, because of the volatility, so that the CoGas contract, when that was negotiated at the end, if I'm reading this correctly, in late 2006, when oil was $50 a barrel, it has increased commensurately with that, so it's a constantly or daily or changing contract, or you know, some formula to that effect?
Typically in the LNG sales and purchase agreements, there is not a daily adjustment. It's frequently on a 3-month trailing average basis. But yes, as the oil price moves, there is a direct correlation with the contractual sales price.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shipkoff. You may have answered this question, but I understand the connectivity, the ribbon that attaches natural gas prices to oil prices in the Asian markets. Did I understand you to say that because of this connectivity and because there is a relationship between the price of oil and the price of natural gas, that a contract to buy gas in Asia is a long-term contract? I mean, what is a long-term contract? Is it 20 years? Is it 10 years? Is it?
These contracts tend to be 20 to 25 years, yes. Okay. Now, there has been a lot of speculation in the market, and that speculation has somewhat died out in recent couple of years, that contract terms will be going down, meaning it will be going to some tenors that are shorter than 20 years. There was a lot of talk about this at various LNG conferences around 2002, 2003, and 2004. But what happened is the perception of a seller-friendly market increased, and sellers want longer-term contracts because that enhances their ability to finance their projects. So in this environment, it's very difficult to see how any buyer would be able to negotiate anything less than 20 years, and it's just not happening.
And Mr. Chair, a follow-up question. I mean, in the contracts, are there any kind of provision for reopeners on the part of either party, the seller or the buyer?
Yes. Typically, there are price reopener provisions, which and they can be formulated differently in different contracts. But sometimes what you see is there is a envisioned band of pricing for oil, which is, between, in the old contract, it used to be somewhere between 15 and 25, which was what the parties at the time thought was the reasonable expectation for long-term prices. And if the price moves beyond that, either you could have two things happen, and sometimes both of these things could happen in successive stages. You could have, one, the formula changes in some way that make if, in other words, the curve is flattened. In other words, if the band is exceeded, typically, historically, the case has been that the buyer starts benefiting above the range. In other words, the price is less than what it would have been if that break in the slope had not occurred. And if the price goes below the expected range, so in the old case is below $15, then the seller starts benefiting because the price increases relative to what it would have been without that. The other thing that could happen, that could be triggered contractually, is if a certain band is exceeded, it could be a different band, then the parties are forced to negotiate with each other and come up to an alternative arrangement. It's not always clear how that works in reality.
And Mr. Chair, just make sure that I understand the band concept. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume that because of the price of oil right now, that a lot of bans have been broken in contracts that had been signed prior to January of 2008. Is that a correct assumption?
A lot of the old vintage contracts have exceeded their bans a long time ago, yes.
And if I could follow up, Mr. Chair, because of that, I mean, have there been either buyers walking away from the previous contracts or sellers walking away from the previous Asian contracts?
Well, to a certain degree, it becomes a bit of a, you know, game of gamesmanship. If the two parties can't agree, they're both in trouble, right? So they have to come up to some reasonable resolution. Now, a contract is still a contract, so if they cannot agree, the contract still prevails. So the question is, does the buyer want to risk pushing its seller to a point where they really want to turn around and go somewhere else? On the other hand, the seller may not be able to risk, depending on the terms of the contract, may not be willing to risk breaking the contract and incurring contractual penalties that may cost them. So, unfortunately, I cannot give you a more specific answer. It really depends on the situation and what the condition, what the perceptions of the buyer and seller in question are about where each one of them is going, what other opportunities they have, and
Thank
so
you,
on.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
And Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at this chart, and it's, I can't hardly believe the differences in what takes place even from early 2005 to the end of 2006, a two-year period, with one that basically has what appears to be a very different strategy in it, or very different contractual terms, where it is a flat rate versus one that is going up at a 45-degree angle along accompanying. Is that due to just simply changes in the theory and the contracts that were written? Is that what amounts to there, that we're looking at?
The flat line, which I think you're looking at, which is the pink one at the bottom, China.
And the green as well.
The green one actually is not entirely flat. It looks flat, but it should be a little bit less flat than that. But especially the pink one, which is China, is instructive. This is was considered kind of a one-off type event. What happened was there was a contract with China, which was executed by BP to supply the Chinese market in the expectation that there will be a huge growth in the Chinese LNG market, and that did not materialize because the Chinese are very price sensitive. They, you know, they have a lot of coal, and they don't like to burn expensive gas if they can burn cheap coal. So as prices have risen, their appetite for LNG has declined correspondingly. So this was the Chinese market. The Chinese contract is largely perceived as an attempt to gain an entry and a foothold into the Chinese market, and has not really set a precedent. If anything, it has been every contract since then has broken that precedent.
I guess timing is everything. Thank you.
Yes, and the timing now is perceived to be very highly favorable to suppliers and sellers. Now, having said this, the next question is, what is it going to be in, you know, 2012 or whenever we get to the point where we're actually, we've brought the project to a point where we're going to be executing a definitive contract. The Port Authority does not believe that the current highly favorable seller's market will continue. We have not assumed that we're going to be able to sell gas in our base case under the, for example, the co-gas formula, you know, above $17 per MMBTU if oil is 100. The administration's consultant on LNG pricing, which was Gas Strategies, has put out a report, which for the most part we think is a very good report. They have presented a set of three cases.
Mr. Resloff, or Mr. Skipoff, let me stop you there. We were scheduled to three. We've gone over that to some degree, and we would like to have you back tomorrow, Mr. Walker, with the administration to have a discussion about the difference in the courses of action we're talking about here in the economics. Would that be feasible for you? Because some of us have meetings here scheduled just shortly, so.
Mr. Chairman.
It would be the same time, 1 o'clock.
Okay. I'll need to consult with Mr. Scruff. He was scheduled to catch a flight out tonight back to Washington, D.C.
My limitation is my wife is in sort of very advanced stages of pregnancy, so I have to consult whether I'm actually allowed to stay another day. So.
Yeah, well, you may have to do a mental transfusion for Mr. Walker, but...
Mr. Chairman, we understand the limitation of time. We appreciate your graciousness today, and we look forward to tomorrow the best we could.
I don't know, can we get at the least a teleconference connection?
I'll be happy to do teleconference. The problem is I'm not sure I'll make it back in time to do that, because it will take me some time to get back to Washington.
Well, we'll let you sort that out, but we will reconvene in the morning tomorrow afternoon at 1 p.m. to carry on where we are here. Unless there are any questions, we're adjourned until tomorrow.